everyone. I'm Paul, and I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic. My sobriety date is July 11th, 2019, which is the date of my last drink, but also the date that I did actually my first three steps fully, even though the alcohol and drugs probably didn't fully leave my body for a couple of days. Then it's still 7-11 is just kind of easy date for me to remember. And today I am 1 month shy of celebrating 4 years without having had to take a drink or a drug, since drugs are also part of my story. This is the first time I've been asked to speak at a speaker's meeting. I'm honored and humbled and grateful to the Blue Ridge Speakers Group for this opportunity to share my experience, strength, and hope. I'm also nervous. I'm wearing a tie. So, breathe. Take it easy. I was just asked to do this last Tuesday by my buddy Dale, and it's been an emotional roller coaster to reflect over the entirety of my 60 couple of years life and review it and try to put it together and present it in some kind of sensible chronological way. And so I wrote this to share. In the interest of not forgetting the important points, I hope you bear with me. I'll probably do some reading just to kind of remind me checkpoint where I'm through this. But I promise to keep the 10th grade history teacher voice drone down to a minimum and interact with us. I know I don't like that. So here goes with what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. In suburban Philadelphia, my family was my mom, my dad, my brother Steve, and me, and we also lived with my paternal grandmom in the house that my paternal grandfather had built, and which my dad grew up. So I mean, that was his home, his whole thing. My family was Italian on my dad's side, German on my mom's side, and they really liked the party, man, I'm here to tell you. I mostly remember being happy and secure as a younger child growing up. Dad worked in the carpeting business, and also for a while, he was 4 years a teacher in the inner cities of Philadelphia public school system. Mom, she kept a spotless home, and she did all the domestic things. And me and Steve, we played a lot together. He's 14 months older than I, so we really were pretty close in age and going through life's experiences the same way. Had a lot of cousins local because my dad comes from a big family. So we played with them and neighborhood kids. I enjoyed and I did well in school, and I was encouraged by my parents to work hard at my studies and music and sports and the arts. They were very supportive of pretty much whatever I wanted to do. I was raised without religious training, however. My Italian grandma, like I say, who I lived with, she was a robust, enthusiastic Roman Catholic. And I think in response to her trying to push that on my dad kind of was like, nah, you know, you kids, you're going to find God in your own way at your own time kind of thing. So he kind of shielded me and my brother from like, you got to be this kind of religion or these kind of belief systems. My mom had a quiet and personal faith. I think she was Lutheran that she practiced, but you know, really she didn't force that on us either. There is a story that my mom told me when I was much older, this is, I was probably in my 20s, where she went against my dad's wishes. He did not want his kids to be stamped. He actually literally stamped as a Christian. My mom went and secretly had me and my brother baptized at a church by her parents' house in Philadelphia. And she said this to me at the time somewhat apologetically. She said it was at a time when she was very ill and she, from her beliefs, really feared for my brother and my soul if we were not baptized. I was so young that I have absolutely no memory of this. And really my takeaway from my mom's reveal was just, you know, I had respect for her to stand up for her beliefs. So in my family, like the major Christian holidays, Christmas and Easter, we just kind of celebrated them like Thanksgiving and Halloween and 4th of July. And you know, they were just big get-togethers, a lot of partying, a lot of food, a lot of drinks, laughter, gifts. These folks, as I said, they like to party. So I was exposed to many examples of continually associating eating, drinking with what a good time was. Although later I was to learn that also my estranged paternal grandfather, as well as two of my uncles, were alcoholic. I don't remember there being fights or screaming or stuff getting broken. I just remember raucous good times, a lot of laughter, a lot of talking, a lot of music. There would always be music playing in the background. Let's see this. Yeah, and a bunch of us cousin kids all running around at the lower altitude of the party, right? You know, amongst all the trees of the parents' legs. And I also have recalls that, you know, I was one of the younger cousins, but like, you know, I wanted to be part of what the big people were doing because they looked always like they were having such a good time. Me and my brother actually created our own little saying. It's kind of a toast. Drinks for drunks and drunks for drinks. We all sneeze at you. The adults thought this was roaringly funny, I guess, coming from a 7 and 8 year old or something. I remember my first drink. So this is, I was in third grade playing over my friend's house one day after school. We were just, you know, kicking around like a couple of knuckleheads. And Phil just kind of out of the blue says, "Hey, Paul, you want to try a drink?" And I really didn't know what he was talking about because I hadn't consumed any alcohol before. So I was like, "Oh, yeah, okay, you know, I'll do it if you do it, right?" He goes downstairs to his basement well and he brings it back. Bottle of peach brandy, you know, Jackwins in that brown bottle, freaking syrup, right? So he takes a drink and he hands it to me, and I didn't know what to expect. So I'm like, I knock it back and it's sweet and it's warm and I like it. And it must have showed because Phil like was grabbing the bottle in my hand saying, "Whoa, whoa, whoa, you know, I don't want my dad to see that there's been too much missing here." And so we play around a little more, and like in about a minute, right, I get that boom in my gut and that flush that comes up to your face. And I'm like, oh my God, this is what happiness feels like. This is why these adults are all having such a grand time when they're drinking. And I kind of think that at that moment, that's when my alcoholism switched on. We messed around a little bit more at his house. And I remember, one thing I do remember the rest of the afternoon is me bugging Phil to let me have another drink, which he finally relented. Let me have one more small swig. I think once again, he grabbed the bottle on my hand, but yeah, indeed, I think the hook had been set then. Afterwards, my interest in drinking must have been obvious. The next year, my dad and uncles had got a flatbed truck full of grapes pull into our driveway, and they're going to go and start making a couple of casks of homemade wine down in the basement. My fourth grade teacher, she sent a note home to my parents expressing concern over this, what did she call it? It was a obsession, fascination, unhealthy interest over what was going on down in the wine cellar. And I also remember starting to be allowed some sips of beer and wine at family parties. Now I'm like 12 or 13 at this point. I didn't get drunk yet, but I do remember start to feel like a little buzz from it. And also they would let me drink coffee so I could throw some caffeine buzz into that mix too. But most of all, it's like I was now participating with what the adults were doing. So I was kind of getting that feeling that I was being grown up also. And things really changed for me when I was 13 going on 14. I had been learning about drugs in junior high school health class, right? They were bad. They were dangerous. They were illegal. And so in spite of me dabbling with the legal drug ethanol, I just couldn't understand why anybody would want to mess up their heads that bad and just change what they were thinking about so much by doing these drugs, right? And also, I didn't know anybody who did drugs, so it was like totally foreign to me why people would do this. So this is 1974, right? My family is now going to throw this big 40th birthday bash for my dad, surprise party. They had decorated the house all up in groovy 60s. I don't know if anybody remembers Rowan and Martin Laughing, right? It was like all the stuff from there, a little the clock with the arms and stuff. The place was jam-packed with people. It wasn't a big house to start out with, but you know, everybody's going around, I guess. It was just totally raucous house party going on. When the kids, me and my brother, were told, all right, it's time for y'all to go to bed, I remember we couldn't sleep because there's still so much noise and commotion going on from downstairs. So I think at some point my brother snuck downstairs to see like what was still going on. And apparently he saw my dad and uncles and friends smoking weed. And so the next day he asked my dad about, you know, what's up with this? And my dad admits, he said, I don't smoke weed. The instant I heard that, my opinion on altering one's consciousness just turned 180 degrees. My dad asked if we wanted to try something, and he smoked a joint with me and my brother. Even though I didn't feel high that first time smoking weed, I was totally sold on the idea of it was now desirable and admirable and sophisticated and grown up to want to change your consciousness, get drunk and get high. Being that I was also, I'm like, what, 13, 14, right? At that stage of adolescent development where you have to start defining yourself. You're a jock, you're a preppy, you're a bookworm, you're a nerd, you're fill in the blank, whatever. And so I view this experience as, all right, I will define myself as a stoner. So much so that I actually remember trying to look stoned walking down the halls of junior high, so like all the other kids, especially girls, would think I was just so cool, man. All right. So I began getting high with my dad and some older cousins, and also getting more involved in drinking at family parties. I would get beers for people. I would mix drinks at the parties. And I would always ask, like, "Hey, can I have one?" Or, "Hey, you know, let me taste that to see if I mixed it right for you." You know, this resulted in me starting to get a little drunk, but not badly at first. Although this did escalate. And I think I was 15 at an annual family Christmas party, and I'm there, I'm playing bartender, and I'm mixing all kinds of different drinks for the folks that were coming into my uncle's little bar study thing. I think y'all know where this is going to end up at, right? After a while, my dad notices I can't focus my eyes anymore standing up there. Takes me outside for some air, and just in time for me to get violently sick all over the backyard. My family had to leave the party early, take me home, put me to bed, and it probably was a mildish case of alcohol poisoning. And needless to say, this raised some red flags with my parents, and there were some long talks about responsible drinking. But my addiction, it had taken over by that point. And really the lesson I was learning was I needed to hide my level of intoxication. And as long as I could just not act drunk, I could keep partaking. And I could continue. You know? And so was born this modus operandi for me for the next 43 years of my abuse. As long as I didn't act drunk, I wasn't drunk. I was good. I was cool. I was okay. I could handle it. And so it cemented into me a work hard, party harder kind of justification system that ruled my behaviors. I would do well or like well enough, right? Or in school so that teachers and my parents couldn't accuse me of being a burnout, a drunk, a loser. But it created this closed loop feedback system where I'll work hard to achieve, and then because I achieved, I deserved hedonistic pleasure, the excess of which I could make up for by achieving more, and so on and so on. And as a result of that, my tolerance and my capacity for consumption is growing, as was my reputation for being the kid who would smoke more weed and drink like a heavyweight and push the limits. And I was always like the last guy that they had to kick out from the party. You know, you got to go home now. And this is pretty much how it went my mid to late teens in the late 1970s. I had also started playing in bands and gave me access to a number of bars where I could go and drink as long as I kept it cool. I thought everything was great because I wasn't experiencing any real negative consequences to this point. So what's the problem? Why change? The one consequence I didn't particularly care for was my parents getting on me about coming home drunk at times. So to take care of that, after I got out of high school, I put myself into a 2-year technical college so I get a job that would allow me to live on my own and not on my parents' roof. And so now this is early 1982. I was hired by IBM and I relocated down to their spot there in Manassas, Virginia. So now I was free to drink without any constraints beyond my own wanting to not be too hungover. So I could go to work, you know, not too often, and folks wouldn't notice too much. Having moved away from my drug contacts from back in the old neighborhood, now alcohol really became like my exclusive drug of choice. I was drinking 3 or 4 beers or 6-pack pretty much every weekend night, and a good bit more on the weekends. I got my driver's license a month after I moved to Virginia, and I experienced now my first major consequence of drinking, which is my first DUI. The consequence turned out not to be all that severe for me, because back in that day, you could avoid license suspension and worse if you paid your fines, and they had this thing called the Alcohol Safety Action Program, or ASAP. You go to these classes. And so that's what I did. You know, again, kind of a slap on the wrist thing. And I learned I have to be hyper-vigilant and drive like really careful. And, you know, because there's all these cops out here forever that are just always looking for a young kid, young male, driving on weekend nights. Now, that was the lesson I learned, not the one they're trying to teach me, that if you drink, let somebody else drive. You know, that's way, way too sensible for me to get. And so since I was insisting on internalizing my lesson, right, a year later, I get a second DUI. And yet still, I'm blaming the cops. Yeah? My drinking had nothing to do with this situation. It's those guys who are out to get me. Yeah, right. For the second DUI, I did receive a 6-month suspended license. But again, I managed to make that not so onerous because I was rooming with a guy who I worked with right with IBM, so he would drive me to work, and his wife and he would chauffeur me around to different places, grocery shopping, going to restaurants, and I would pay for the gas, I would pay for booze, I would take him out to dinner, that kind of stuff. And I was also literally dating the girl next door, and so she would drive. She would drink a little, but not as much as me, and that was cool by me, right? More on my tab. I haven't mentioned dating much to this point because my main squeeze really was the bottle. So what it was. It's ironic because my main reason for wanting to get drunk is like a lot of y'all, where that's what turned me into the brilliant conversationalist and the really excellent dancer who was just not afraid to go up and approach good-looking women and chat them up. But invariably, for whatever dating I did end up doing this way, the lady was always a runner-up, second place to me getting drunk. And I was like, hey, this is me. I like to party. And if you have a problem with it, well, there's the door. I even went so far as to rationalize this by saying that I only wanted casual date, didn't matter what it was. And I wouldn't even entertain anything like a serious relationship until I turned 30. More on that later. So that was me in my 20s. Work, party, drink, casual dating. I was also playing part-time in a band. I was thoroughly convinced I was having the time of my life. It was just all there. Even though sometimes it felt a little shallow, especially like when I looked at what my other contemporaries were doing. You know, they were advancing in their career. They were buying nicer cars. They were buying houses. They were getting married. But you know, when those thoughts came in, just drink them away. And it's just not an issue anymore. I was doing what I wanted. And it was like, this was Paul in control, driving the whole bus. So how could anything be wrong, right? And in the summer of 1988, I got my third DUI. I was driving up 95 to visit my folks for a July 4th weekend. I got busted in Maryland for speeding. And my folks had to come down to Philly to bail me out of jail. And thankfully, they did so right before the magistrate office closed, or else I would have spent like days in jail and not hours. I was pretty bad at that point. I think I blew 0.28 BAC. And I also, looking back as I was coming through this, I remember a couple other times where I was so drunk driving that I actually just went right through a red light and had to panicky steer my car to avoid getting hit. And I had this sense, I recall this, that it felt like my car was moving to avoid this. And I know now that it's God's hand who was protecting me and the other drivers. But if you had asked me then, I would have said, well, yeah, aren't I lucky? Or even, ain't I a very skilled driver? And instead of being grateful to my folks for bailing me out of jail, I got a resentment against my mom, who insisted on riding home in the truck that morning because I couldn't finish drinking that 4-pack of wine coolers that I brought for the ride up. I was that sick. That was just where my head was at. So back at my parents' house that weekend, my mom and dad confronted me with this. So, Paul, do you still think that drinking is not a problem for you? And I had to admit, it's like, yeah, things have gotten out of control. I didn't drink that weekend. And that was the first time in several years that I abstained for a couple of days. But I think it was probably more so from embarrassment, and I didn't want to disappoint my mom and dad anymore at that point, than for, you know, really feeling this is the right thing to do for myself. Once I got back to Virginia, and now I'm facing uncertain consequences from this arrest. So I call up the company's employee assistant hotline and say, man, I need some help. Stop drinking. And I enrolled in a part-time outpatient rehab program at the Culpeper Hospital there. And that's how I was first introduced to AA. It was summer of 88. My mindset, however, I was still limited to this, hey, I just want to do what I need to do so to minimize the consequence. And I even told the counselors, like, hey, tell me whatever I need to do so I'll end up looking good for the judge at my trial and the eventual sentencing. So I did become a model outpatient client, and the worst outcomes were avoided. Kind of got away again with a slap on the wrist. The rehab and aftercare required me to go to AA meetings, and y'all know about having little sheets that you got to get signed. And so I would go and I would listen, I would do that, but I still was like one of those guys last to show up and the first to leave kind of thing. And I just, you know, because I got to tell you, I found UAAers to be this weird cult-like thing with all your slogans and sayings and whatnot. What I think now, looking back on it, is just I was so used to people putting on fronts, false faces, which, you know, that's what I was doing, that I just couldn't get my mind around this notion of here are people that have, right, this connection with your higher power. And it's actually helping you to be serene and happy. I mean, I couldn't get it, man. I couldn't. And so after the rehab program thing didn't require me to go to AA meetings, I stopped going. It still had been like the longest time I'd been continually sober for well over a decade. And I felt better because I was not actively self-destructing. Things were getting good at work. I had money because I wasn't drinking away. I bought a new stereo, a new car, went on some nice vacations. I went and saw the Super Bowl live down in Miami that year. Great game. Go Niners. I bought some new music gear, and I discovered the joy of playing music and sounding good at it without having to have that crutch of at least a half pint to get juices flowing. And I was convinced I'd solved my drinking problem, since now I believed I could do whatever I wanted so long as I didn't drink. And that's, you know, people ask me, well, Paul, now that you're not drinking, what are you doing? I would say, whatever I want. Whatever I want, right? You hear that? Self-will just lives deep with me. And but deep, you know, because that self-will, I still deep down I could have this sense of discontent, and I wasn't comfortable in my own skin for any real long, meaningful period of time. My relationships nonetheless got better with my family and friends, and also with women, so much so that when me and the lady I've been dating at the time, steady for several months, found out that we were pregnant, we decided we were going to get married. Remember that thing I said about no serious relationships? I was 30, right? 2 days after my 30th birthday, I'm getting married. Hey, God. You know, real fun, right? Okay. Although I was abstinent like several month periods of time now, my addiction would still show up from time to time, as long as I was assured that I would get away with it. The wife was out of town, or, you know, I would sneak a drink or two, catch a little buzz, and I got pretty good at hiding it. I discovered cooking wine has alcohol in it, and it doesn't have so much salt that it will make you sick, just like taste. Yeah. So that was my pretense of being sober for most of my 30s. Generally, I was frustrated and not especially content with life, because I still was in this, you know, man, if I could only get this, or if only this would happen for me kind of mindset, then I would be happy. You know, the whole, why can't the whole world just do what I want it to do thing. We had two kids who I honestly cherish and adore. I believe they are the best things that ever happened in my life. I knew I was about to choke upon that. My daughter Shelby suffered a traumatic birth that resulted in severe mental disabilities. And then 2 years later, my son Nick came along, and he was like the opposite. I think he's really a genius. Neither child was subject to my active alcoholism when they were young growing up, but I'm sure they just got the sense that there are times I could be moody, discontent, and impatient. Ours was not an unhappy home. I was fully committed to this, you've got to keep the peace of the marriage at all costs. And that was based on the model of my parents, who had a lifelong union. So I stuffed a lot of things, and you know, I know that's not healthy, and that resulted, I'm sure, with just an underlying level of tension, keeping our house from being more fully joyful than it otherwise could have been. So one day after like 11 years of this, my wife come home from a business trip and announces she wants me to move out and for us to get divorced. I reluctantly agreed to what I thought would be a trial separation, although it turned out not to be in the case, since she just wanted me to be gone from the house for a year for grounds for divorce, so that she could almost immediately marry the guy she was on the business trip with. So, all right. And needless to say, I was once again back out on my own, and I started drinking regularly again. The whole poor me, my wife kicked me out, blah, 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 blah. And during the separation, I got fourth DUI. And this one really shook me. I knew that I had to change so that I wouldn't want to drink anymore, but I didn't know how. So this time I give AA another try with much more willingness than before. But I was like still too bitter over the divorce and too self-willed to really grasp what you spoke of here, the spiritual precepts of this program. I could do the first step, right? Powerless over alcohol, and my life had become unmanageable. But when I got to that second part where I was talking about a power greater than myself, that was just like the bridge too far for me to say, yeah, there's God. So I couldn't let go and let God. That was just abandoning the only thing that I ever knew, which is me. And I just, I wasn't there yet. I wasn't there yet. So I white knuckled abstinence for a while. But after a year, I stopped going to meetings. But my life, it actually did get better. And I was going 5 or 6 months without drinking. And I was like, okay with that. What would happen is my forgetter would kick in. And I would just say, okay, it's all right to have a drink. And I would get drunk during a weekend. I say, I wouldn't do this around family or friends or anything. It's just by myself. I would suffer this horrific hangover because, I wasn't I wasn't used to drinking, and I had these really horrible hangovers. And I'd say, okay, yeah, dummy, that's why you don't do that. And then I was, all right, just don't drink. And I'll go back to living a pretty good life for the next half a year or 8 months or so. My kids had gotten out of high school. I'd landed a really good IT job right there in Culpeper. My finances were once again in good shape, and I'd come to terms with dealing with my ex as regards to issues regarding our children. And I was also enjoying playing part-time in a band again. Then now we're up to like 2011. I started steady dating a lady. Now, she was a drinker, but she didn't seem to be problematic at the time. And we had a lot of fun. We got each other. And after 10 months, where it was like, all right, you drink, that's cool. I just choose not to. Come to my company's Christmas party, and I make a decision. I was very conscious that I was going to do this controlled drinking experiment. And it was okay. Like, I sipped 3 or 4 beers throughout the course of the evening. It got a little buzz. But that was the extent of what I was allowing myself for that. So with the confidence of that experience, a month later, we go on this 2-week vacation to Hawaii. And during which I began drinking like for what me was regular. Having given up the pretense of trying to control my drinking, I was off to the races again, right? The thing about this being a progressive disease. And when you start again, it is just as bad as where you were when you left off before. It doesn't matter how much time intervenes, like you just pick up right where you were. And that was exactly what happened to me. I was back to drinking most of the time when I wasn't working. And that lady who she'd moved in with me, she kept up with me. So like we were throwing gas on each other's fire. Wasn't really good. And then over the next couple of years, I even started drinking again with my family and friends. And first they were like, Paul, are you sure you know what you're doing here? Because they had remembered me mostly being abstinent from previous. So I was, hey, man, I'm cool. I got it. And they bought my lie. And I was functional like most of the time that I could pull it off, at least for a while. Then in 2015, my living girlfriend, that lady, she moved away to Texas to care for her newly born grandchild. And again, here I am. I'm left all by myself, me and booze. And DUI number 5, which came with several $1,000s in lawyer fees, fines, classes, ignition interlocks, license restrictions. It's probably close to 10 grand in all. And 4 days in jail. All of which did not lessen my desire or my conviction to drink. I would just abstain long enough to get it out of my system when I knew that they were going to check me, screen me. And once all my debts had been fulfilled, society, now this is like mid-2016, got the classes done, got the interlocks taken off, got my license back. And I was right back to unrestricted drinking. And the next 3 years was nothing more than poorly managed chaos. During that time, I had met and gotten engaged to the woman who is now my lovely bride, but I treated her like everybody else, second-class citizen to my drinking. And as a result, I ended up alienating her, my children, my extended family, my dad. I didn't have any friends at this point. No one wanted anything to do with this drunk. Work was putting up a good bit of pressure on me because of my decreasing performance and increasing absenteeism. Even my dog died. Not a good time. Life had regressed to this endless, pointless cycle of waking up hungover, dragging myself into work, surviving somehow enough to make it through to 5 o'clock, then straight away to the 7-Eleven or the ABC store, start drinking as soon as I got back in the car, drive home, drink alone, watching TV at night till I passed out, and just wake up, hungover, and repeat. My health was also going downhill directly as a relationship to the alcohol abuse. I was overweight, I was taking pills for cholesterol, I was taking pills for high blood pressure and edema, pills for anxiety, pills for depression. Blood tests revealed that I was suffering fatty liver disease onset. And I was also self-medicating with THC vaping for bouts of insomnia. So by July 2019, I'm kind of at that point where I'm thinking I'm finished with this drinking game. And also part of this was my fiance and family that issued this. You go into rehab, you get yourself help, or just don't even bother showing up anymore, ultimatum. So I called the employee assistant hotline again, and I made arrangements to check myself into a 28-day inpatient rehab. It was in Arlington, the Phoenix House. My son Nick would take time away from his life and his work down in Richmond, come up and drive me from the hospital to the rehab place. And I show up drunk at the hospital. Of course, that's what I did. And blood tests showed also the presence of benzos I'd been taking and THC. And Nick meets me at, now this is the Culpeper Hospital where I'm getting this detox, this medical detox assessment, I guess is what it was. And even though my BAC is twice the legal limit, they release me to Nick, I guess, because they think, well, he's going to take me right to the rehab. And the rehab lady who we're coordinating with is telling Nick, you make sure your dad doesn't drink anything more today. So, clever me, right? I tell Nick, all right, dude, you drive your car back to my house 10 minutes away. I'm going to drive the truck back there, and then we'll take your car and drive in Arlington to the rehab. I stop by the 7-Eleven and get me a Four Loko and chug that on the way down. Of course. Once Nick gets me to the rehab intake, the lady says, you're too drunk for us to accept you, and you will immediately go to the local hospital ER and request an alcohol detox. And depending on how long that procedure takes, could be days, you very well might lose that spot that we had reserved for you, that bed reservation. And right there, my world shattered and everything came crashing down at that point. I was finally desperate enough to admit my way doesn't work. And I must ask for and receive help from other people if there was going to be any chance of me changing my life from the pointless hell I had made it. I finally did truly my first step. Admitting powerlessness and unmanageability. And since I was accepting that somebody else has got to fix me, I can't do it. I'm all out of answers and moves and shiftiness. You know, I believe I did my second step, even though like at the time, I didn't really have a real conception of what is this power greater than myself that shall restore me to sanity. I'm forever grateful and indebted to my son for saving my life that day when he drove me to the ER and waited with me until they actually admitted me for the detox, whereas he could have quite reasonably and understandably just told me, "The hell with you," and just left my ass on the street. I wouldn't blame, nobody would have blamed. My first day in detox was a benzo haze. Second day, they cut back on the meds and asked if I was feeling well enough to go attend a counseling session. And at this point, I was like, man, whatever you suggest, I will do. I was beaten into that state of reasonableness they talk about. And I did everything that they suggested. And the third day, I attended an AA meeting because they would bring them into the hospital with a willingness I'd never before had. I picked up a 24-hour chip. The next day, the hospital folks thought that I was healthy enough to be admitted to the outpatient rehab. And by the grace of God, that bed spot was still open for me. I mean, and I saw when I got there, it's like, there's a lot of turnover. And sometimes booked and some, and it's like, you know, these little gaps come in, they try and keep it full. So it was the grace of God that got me in there. Certainly nothing I did, right? So again, I had no idea to what to expect in this inpatient rehab thing, but you know, my whole attitude was, you suggest it and I will do it without reservation or complaint, because finally dawned on me that what I needed was spiritual help. At the AA meetings they held several times a week at the rehab place, these words that I was hearing people speak and how it works, they stuck out to me. But there is one who has all power. Once God may find him now. And even today at meetings, when that part is read, I recite, "May you find him now," to myself out loud, to remind myself that, you know, that's the absolute foundational bedrock of my recovery and is the source of miracles. So for the first time in my adult life, I gave up control. I made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood him, even though I'd say I didn't really have a clear comprehension at the time of what this higher power was. I knew in my soul that he was there and he would accept me. Having done the first three steps, this is what happened to me. This is exactly what it says in the big book. And I'm going to read this because, you know, this is perfectly applicable. It says this and we have a solution. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude towards life, toward our fellows, and toward God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do for ourselves. If you are seriously alcoholic as we were, we believe there is no middle-of-the-road solution. We were in a position where life was becoming impossible, and if we had passed into this region from which there is no return through human aid, we had but two alternatives. One was to go into the bitter end, blotting out consciousness of our intolerable situation as best we could, and the other was to accept spiritual help. This we did because we honestly wanted to and were willing to make the effort. This is exactly what happened to me. And as a result, I found much of heaven and have been rocketed into a fourth dimension of experience of which I had not even dreamed. So this is what it is like now. Come to that part. I felt like a new person. I guess the willingness with which I embraced my recovery was evident to the rehab, since they released me in 3 weeks. I heard that, or my insurance was going to bank that fourth week as a hedge against, you know, what is statistically probable a relapse. I was still not on solid ground. Oops, I'm sorry, I got this. Having gotten out, I was still a little confused. The first thing I did was go to a meeting, get a where and when, get phone numbers, and I set myself to looking for a sponsor to replace the temporary one I had in rehab. Phil, this real nice guy, lived in Maryland, and he was taking meetings into the rehab spot. Most importantly, for the first time in my life, I wasn't afraid of the uncertainty that lay before me. Well, I was a little bit, but at those times I would just quiet my mind, I would pray, and I would trust that everything was going to work out the way it was supposed to. I held on to that trust that my higher power would take care of my needs and my wants, especially my wants, since he clearly knew better than me, you know, based on the choices I had been making. I didn't do a full 90-90, but I did get a sponsor, Steve, y'all might know him, and I was making 4 or 5 meetings a week. I was staying busy at work and at my house, which had been in shambles. I took suggestions from wherever they came with an attitude of trust so that as long as it came from somebody who had more sobriety than I did, it was probably at least a good idea to try it out, right? I was still not on real solid ground trying to conceptualize my higher power. So my sponsor laid it out pretty simple. He said, your higher power can be anything you want it to be. It can be anything you can think of. Just make sure it's not you. Yeah. That I could get my mind around. And it still works for me today. I often use words God or him in capital H to speak of this entity, but I don't mean to imply it is or has to be any God presented in any religion that I would be familiar with. It really is God of my understanding. And I'm also totally invested in allowing that to grow and change as he reveals more to me. You know, so, and that to me is, that's just like, why I couldn't get that before. You know, it was like I had this mindset that people had to tell me who God was. And now it's been revealed to me that I can find who he is. It's a beautiful thing, man. In the practicalities of my life, relationships with my fiance, my children, my family have been restored. I explained to them how recovery was working in my life. I was making friends in AA and beginning to get this strange sense that like people actually started to enjoy interacting with me. And there were folks who like actually seemed glad to see me. What a concept. At work, I was getting back on track. And after about a year, I was seeing raises and bonuses again. Then COVID hit and my dad died, but we hung together. With the support of the people in this program, I was able to manage my loss and my frustrations such that I didn't have to drink. Part of this was listening to the message that it wouldn't make anything better. Part of it was making a conscious effort to not ignore, not lose sight of some of the good things that were happening in my life and seeking gratitude wherever I could find it. Some of those things I was grateful for, my special needs daughter finally got selected off the wait list that she'd been waiting on for over a decade to receive funding for social services to support her independent living. Like my son being successful in challenges he faced in his life and job, like looking at other people's victories. And that whole losing interest in selfish things and gaining interest in my fellows thing. 2 years ago, I married my lovely bride. And while relationships still present struggles for me, I have confidence that you all have given me the tools and support to find a good way forward. Mostly because I just don't feel fear or worry about outcomes. My sponsor advises it's okay to plan the activities, just don't plan the outcomes. I can do that because I continue to believe everything will work out according to God's design. And it's my job to go with that flow and not force people, places, or things to submit to my will. My reward for doing this is serenity in myself and in those around me. Guy yesterday commented that while we were setting up at this gig, and we were the only guys who showed up on time because the rest of the band was all caught in this crash on 522, and they were half an hour, 45 minutes delayed. And he looked at me and was like, man, you're so chill. I just told him, I was like, dude, I don't fight anymore. He's like, man, that's got to be your superpower. Roxanne and I, we decided to move in together, and there was that whole overwhelming prospect of selling both of our houses, buying a new house, moving everything and our five cats into this place. And I mean, that turned out better than I ever could have dreamed of. Because I just kept the attitude of God, if you want this to happen, you will make it so. Just show me my part in what I should, and just as importantly, should not be doing. My financial situation got such that we were able to retire this year, which I am enjoying immensely. I have quite a lot to do around the new house. And this year I got the opportunity to get back into playing music again, which has taken off so much. I'm now playing more than I have at any other point in my life. There really is nothing in my life that I feel is wanting at this point. I make a couple of meetings a week because I feel it when I don't. I serve as GSR for my group, my home group, Culpeper Friday Night Group. I also serve as the treasurer for District 39. I am working steps 4 through 7 with my sponsor, which may be a little slow paced, but my purpose is to work my recovery well, not fast. It's going to last the rest of my life, and I'm in no rush to get to the end of that. I keep my chip with me wherever I go. I've been told that when I get an urge to take a drink, I should put this in my mouth. And once it dissolves, then it will be okay to take a drink. So I keep it with me. I owe all of this life I now enjoy to you, to the fellowship of AA, and to my higher power. You all have taught me how to feel gratitude, and you've given me the tools with which to be gracious to my fellows. You have revealed to me the box in which I jailed myself and how to transcend that box, how to be relieved of the bondage of self, that victory over my difficulties may bear witness to those I would help, of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. Y'all showed me the box in which I hid myself from my higher power. When I removed that box, y'all showed me he is everywhere, that I choose to look for him. And he always has been, and he always will be. Y'all have set me free. Thank you. Yeah.